right, we'll call the case of Linda Ray Cooney versus the state, number 66179. Mr. Castillo going to argue this then? Is that right?
Your Honor, our intention is going to be to divide the time.
Okay.
And I propose that when I approach the lectern.
Okay, Mr. Becker, any time's a good time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Attorney Michael Becker, who along with my co-counsel and former associate, Mr. Michael Castillo, will be arguing on behalf of the appellate. My plan is to take approximately 6 minutes addressing the first two issues in appellate's opening brief, and then Mr. Castillo will address the remainder and will be requesting 4 minutes, and we would jointly request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, which will likely be handled by Mr. Castillo.
Okay. I think the clerk has that. She'll notify you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, ultimately, our position was that the court's willingness to admit the bad act here, which was an acquittal, actually, for a shooting that occurred back in 1992, and the denial of a severance in this case amounted to a denial of my client's fundamental Fifth Amendment rights to a fair trial. And the courts the Supreme Court of the state has said repeatedly that there is always a presumption of inadmissibility when it comes to bad acts. And the reason for that is because the introduction of these bad acts can have a substantial and injurious effect on a jury's verdict. Now, the interesting thing here is we're not talking about a conviction. Under Nevada law, even if this had been a felony conviction under NRS section 50.095, it would not have come in because it was more than 10 years old. And so the idea that we're going to allow a 20-year-old acquittal to come in that's twice as long as old as the remotest felony conviction that would be allowed, there was no precedent whatsoever for this. We did cite in our moving papers, we referenced the fact that Nevada has no defined a case law on this issue as to whether an acquittal is admissible. But we cited and referenced several other states that say, you know, across the board, this is not permitted. You can't allow evidence of an acquittal. And the reason why this is bad is because jurors, you know, there's an old adage, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. So notwithstanding the fact that this was an acquittal, and of course the defense can argue, hey, she was acquitted, this shouldn't be used against her, people don't look at it that way, and juries don't look at it that way. The way it was presented in our case was that she had gotten away with something before, and that this was part of a pattern on the part of Ms. Cooney, and that they should somehow look at an acquittal differently than the law should look at it. And ultimately, collateral estoppel should have prevented them from using it for that purpose, because in essence, Ms. Cooney faced jeopardy for an event that occurred 20 years ago in Florida in a court in Nevada. The role of the judge is to make certain that a trial is not infected by this kind of stuff, because the judge should know that when the jury hears this, it's going to have a huge impact on the jury. There's a time when you're trying a case, and now I've been trying cases for over 23 years and have approximately 100 jury trials. You could be trying a case for 2 weeks, and everything could be going perfectly, and there could be a 30-second increment of time where testimony comes out, where the shoe drops, and the air simply leaves the courtroom. And that's something that actually never shows up on a transcript. The court reporter doesn't write. Everyone could feel the air leave the courtroom. But that's exactly what happened when the jury heard about this incident in Florida 20 years ago. And that's exactly what should not have been allowed to happen at this trial. Now, the severance issue ties in very closely with the bad acts issue. Because, in essence, when the court decided that the bad act was going to come in, the court limited the bad act to the issue of the stalking.
And this was a relatively minor charge in the grand scheme of things. I mean, Ms. Cooney was facing attempted murder charges. And we renewed our motion to sever after the court ruled that it was relevant to the stalking charge. Now, mind you, the testimony from Karina Tatum was that she was aware that Linda Cooney carried a firearm. We proffered that nothing more was needed. It was completely unnecessary and superfluous for the jury to have to hear about her acquittal 20 years earlier in Florida. If the issue was whether a reasonable person in Karina Taylor's position would have been fearful, the fact that she knew that Linda Cooney was known to carry a firearm, the fact that she knew that Linda Cooney, or that we proffered that Linda Cooney had a CCW permit, which knew that she was proficient in the firearm, that was enough to allow the jury to find that there was reasonable fear based on this fact. It's important to note that it never has it been suggested that Ms. Cooney ever used a firearm or threatened Karina Taylor with a firearm. So we believe that it was completely irrelevant to the issue on the stalking charge. But we believe that it was incumbent upon the court to step in and filter this information so as to not taint the jury. The court did give a limiting instruction.
So to be clear, you moved after the court ruled that the 20-year-old incident in Florida could come in. You renewed your motion to sever the stalking charge.
That is correct.
Okay.
And when that motion was denied, we writted the issue up to this court because we knew how important this issue was, and the response we got was it was unnecessary because
we had an adequate remedy on
appeal. But we think that it's time for the court to provide us with that adequate remedy. There is ample law supporting the fact that limiting instructions are not sufficient. And here, although there was a limiting instruction, if you allow the bell to ring, it's hard to unring the bell. And that's what happened here. And it's for that reason that we believe the court erred. What the court could have done, if the court felt that it was important for the jury to hear about the 1993 acquittal in the stalking charges, we could have tried the stalking charge first. We could have then tried the attempted murder charge, and the jury could have heard that Ms. Cooney had been convicted of stalking. But they would not have needed to hear about something that happened 20 years ago, something that was remote in time, and something which this court has consistently said should not be included. Now,
Mr. Becker, I know you're on a roll, but you're eating into your co-counsel's time.
I will close by saying that there are several cases where the court has found that periods of time as little as 45 to 50 days are too remote to allow the complete story. A doctrine to prevail, and we're suggesting that should not have been allowed here, and thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Michael Castillo, also on behalf of the appellant, and unless the court wants to guide me in a different direction, I was going to very briefly address the misconduct which we're attributing to the respondent during closing arguments, as well as their discovery obligations as well. Your Honor, as pointed out on pages 38 through 43 of our opening brief, we're respectfully submitting that the respondent committed misconduct. Number one, by disparaging the testimony of a key witness, Christopher Cooney, the appellant's son, during closing arguments. And number two, by testifying as an expert, essentially, through the admission of a trajectory rod over the defense objections. And as this court is well aware, in reviewing claims of prosecutorial misconduct, there's a standard of Valdez v. State. Number one, is the conduct improper? And number two, does that conduct warrant reversal? And turning to Christopher Cooney, as pointed out in our moving papers, during closing arguments, the state says, quote, so what happens during that 59 minutes and 49 seconds that somehow causes Chris Cooney to need a lawyer? Why would a Metro police officer need a lawyer to testify about or give a statement about what happens in the house? Ask yourself the question, why do people need lawyers? Because they've done something illegal. Now, the key there is, the respondent didn't say, why does Chris Cooney need a lawyer? She said, why do people need lawyers? And that runs afoul of well-established case law, Your Honors, here in Nevada. As the courts are well aware, prosecutorial misconduct results when a prosecutor's statements affect the proceedings with unfairness to make the results of denial of due process. That's Brown v. State. And we submit that is absolutely what happened here. There's deadlock, you state, mentioned both by the respondent and both by us in our reply. Prosecutorial comment on defendant's hiring of counsel is improper. That's an infringement of a defendant's constitutional right to counsel. And further, if the court wants to limit it simply to what was attributed to Christopher Cooney, third case law, Liberal v. State, Voss v. State, a prosecutorial statement of the defense witness is a liar is not a proper argument. With regards to the trajectory rod, I will mostly submit on the moving papers, but I will point out that there was no expert testimony presented. The respondent cites to Alvin v. State, upholding the state's use of annotated photographs, demonstrative exhibits. But the key distinction between our case and Alred, the demonstrative exhibits were in evidence. Here, they were not. So we believe that that was also improper as well. And finally, Your Honors, I would submit that in terms of the state going against its discovery obligations, that was also done in this case, as pointed out in our papers, on pages 33 through 37 of our opening brief. The state said they have an open file policy. That is their words. That was in their responses. If you have an open file policy, then you have an affirmative duty to disclose evidence in the case. And by them not telling us in advance the statements of a key witness, Clarita Kendall, we submit that runs afoul of both Mazin v. State and McKee v. State. And I believe I may be a little short on time, so I'll otherwise save rebuttal for closing unless the court has any questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Steele.
Good morning. May it please the court, Shannon Clowers for the State of Nevada, Chief Deputy District Attorney, and I was trial counsel in this case. I will start with the bad acts. The first bad act that Mr. Becker discusses is the fact that the 1993 acquittal came in. I will point out to the court that it came in a very, very limited fashion. Judge Gonzalez held a very long Petrocelli hearing. The state sought much more to be admitted, and at the end of the Petrocelli, she allowed us to basically do two or three things during the trial, some depending on how the trial progressed in regards to impeachment. She took a lot of time to make those decisions. She carefully weighed the prejudice versus the probative value. And Judge Gonzalez noted that the fact that we had a stalking charge, which requires us to prove a course of conduct, and it's not just a reasonable fear, as Mr. Becker points out, it's an actual fear that the state must prove.
But doesn't that go then to the severance issue? Because didn't a stalking charge operate as the Trojan horse to bring in these prior bad acts that probably would not have been admissible in the attempted murder charge?
Well, I would submit to you that they would have been admissible possibly in the attempt murder charge as well, based upon the testimony of Kevin Cooney. And going to the severance charge, I understand where you're going, and that is, how can we bring in that 1993 only for the limited purpose of the stalking, and then have that attempt murder be sitting there as well? And I submit to you the jury was giving the limited instruction, and the state took extra precaution knowing that we were dealing with a 20-year-old acquittal in this case. And we only brought it in very limited times. It was asked of Karina one time, I believe, on direct. It was asked of Kevin because Kevin had to be impeached with everything that he actually said, and so it was brought in.
But you wouldn't have been asking Kevin. I mean, to me, the question arose, reading this, you would not have been asking Kevin questions about the 1993
acquittal.
And so you wouldn't have been needing to impeach him but for the presence of the stalking charge. I mean, to me, that was the question that occurred to me. So I have trouble using the impeachment of Kevin as a justification for bringing it in at all. And I do think it's highly prejudicial.
And I understand that, and I will submit to you that the way we used it, we limited the prejudice. And one of the ways was we always mentioned it in coinciding with it being self-defense and that there was an acquittal. We never brought up the facts or circumstances or any of the discrepancies.
Would you agree with me then that had the district court ordered that the 1993 killing was inadmissible, granted the in limine on it, there would have been no need to impeach Kevin? You accept that?
No.
On that point?
With all due respect, and there was a point where Judge Gonzalez, during her ruling, noted that it was going to depend on how it played out. It was going to depend on what Kevin said specifically. Going into...
Why was it relevant to what to the case? If you didn't have the stalking charge in the case, would it have been relevant at all? Would you have been asking Kevin about it?
We did not know what the defense was going to be going into this. What Mr. Stoddard and I argued at Petrocelli, partially not knowing it because we'd never spoken to Chris, was that we believed it was going to be a self-defense. And that was indicated early on. And based upon the fact that it was self-defense, we also argued that the 1993 acquittal would have been relevant had they gone with self-defense. And there were many indications they were going to go with self-defense until we got to trial.
How would it have been relevant on self-defense?
Because the state of mind of the defendant, under both circumstances, she's going to come out and say that somebody was coming towards me, attacking me, therefore I had to pull out a gun and shoot her. And there were some discrepancies in the 1993 shooting as well. We brought in the homicide detective from Florida in order to elucidate those in front of Judge Gonzalez. And because we didn't know, we believed it was going to be self-defense when Judge Gonzalez made the ruling at jury trial, it changed to accident.
Wouldn't the jury then have inferred she got away with it once? I mean, what is the actual relevance of the fact that she had that 1993 acquittal?
That goes to the relevance of the state of mind for the stalking charge. And
on the attempted murder issue, how does the 1993 acquittal inform the jury about the state of mind of the defendant at the time of the attempted murder?
We weren't, because they went with accident, it didn't. But because we didn't know what it was, we were still ready and prepared to utilize it.
But when did you know they were going with accident? Opening statements, right?
It was opening statements or when Kevin testified that we first learned that. I don't remember if Mr. Becker brought it up during opening, but when Kevin testified, that's when the entire thing came out that they were going with the accident instead of the self-defense that it had been alluded to before. And I submit to you that, in the words of Mr. Becker, I mean, he stood in front of the court.
What about the 1992 acquittal addressed accident under the other act statute?
We didn't use it for that purpose once they went with accident, and we felt that that was a strategy decision.
It wasn't admissible at all?
It wasn't admissible for purposes of us proving the attempt murder charge, correct. It was admissible for us proving the state of mind for the stalking, and here's where it would get to your
So when was the first time in the trial after opening statement when this was mentioned?
It was never mentioned in opening in the first time it
After
was mentioned.
After the opening statement, what was the first time it came up?
Kevin Cooney. We asked Kevin Cooney if he informed Karina Taylor that his mother previously shot his father in self-defense.
So in response to the state's interrogation, or I should say examination, of Kevin Cooney?
Yes, Your Honor.
In your opening, in your case in chief?
Yes, Your Honor. Or Justice.
Sorry.
Yes, that would be the first time. And going back to what you were talking about earlier, Justice, is how you circle back and where it really comes from is that stalking is imperative to the motive of the attempt murder. Without understanding all of the course of conduct that went into the stalking, there's really no comprehension as to why the attempt murder was committed in this case.
It seems to be, I agree with you, that that's a different discussion to have. The question to me is really the propriety of trying them together, because there are any number of inflammatory issues that came up that were relevant simply on the stalking. So it would maybe perhaps be more probative on the stalking, but certainly grossly prejudicial in a vacuum to the attempted murder. So that's the concern I have, is more with the denial of the severance than the individual admissibility on the stalking.
And I understand that, and I just, we truly believe that every element of the stalking was so important because we had not just a reasonable fear, like an assault standard, we have above and beyond where it goes to the actual fear. And again, that's what led to the attempt murder in this case. Without that stalking or without the behaviors or the course of conduct that led to that stalking, I submit to the court that there wouldn't have been an attempt murder in this case, that Linda Cooney would not have shot her son, that there would have been no reason without that course of conduct. And I submit that all of it intertwines so greatly and so much, that course of conduct, like everything is so related to
it. Why wasn't it sufficient, as defense counsel suggests? To simply inform the jury that she had a gun? Why do we need to get into the 1992 incident even on the stalking charge?
Because during the testimony of Karina Taylor, she did learn that Linda Cooney, in fact, carried a gun. But as what she testified to was her fear was heightened because of the fact that she knew she had previously used the firearm. And that's why I think it would have taken the ability of the state away to present the whole picture to the jury as to what Karina was feeling at the time.
So you're admitting her belief that this woman is dangerous with a firearm in the past, so her belief is the propensity. I mean, that's a bit problematic for the attempt murder context.
Well, we never argued that it was propensity or anything.
No, I know you didn't, but Karina's belief that because this lady has a gun and a CCW and keeps it in her purse, that's not enough proof because she was really scared because 20 years ago,
she
killed someone with that gun. So Karina was afraid that she got away with murder once, this time she'll do it again. I mean, isn't that kind of the...
Well, and I see where you're going with that, and I don't believe that's what Karina necessarily testified to, that she believed that she got away with it. What Karina testified to was that Linda Cooney had previously shot somebody that she was in fear of. And she had also...
I see what you're saying.
Police reports against people, such as Clarita, including Karina, and that's where the fear kind of tied in. So I don't necessarily believe that Karina thought she got away with murder, and most certainly we never alluded to it, and we really tried to sanitize and stay away from prancing around the courtroom just because the judge allowed us to do it, and saying it over and over again. And they were provided the limiting instruction every time that it was said, and as I mentioned, it was said in a very limited fashion. And I do believe that in regards to the severance, that the charges are so intertwined that it's hard to pull them apart.
And not because of the pathological relationships is what you're saying.
Actually, that's a very good way to put it. That's precisely what we had to establish. This was one of the most unusual cases that the state has had to present because we had to go in front of a jury and put a woman who shot her 30-year-old son and explain why, because the question was, why would a mother ever shoot their son? And without knowing all of those things, it doesn't make sense. In addition, why would an MMA fighter be afraid of a woman who's 30 years older than her? And so we had to present sufficient evidence to really establish both of those set of facts, and all of the facts from one case would have most certainly been admissible in the other. And I submit, yes.
But if you had kept out the 93 shooting and acquittal, you still could have done all that.
So you're saying, had the state not presented that, you believe that the state would have still had sufficient evidence to present to the stalking charge?
Right. If you wanted to try the two together, isn't that the price of trying them together and insisting on no severance?
I think the state is always fearful that if we don't present as much evidence as possible, that we'll have prosecutorial regret for lack of a...
Yeah, because you don't get another try. Yeah.
No, we don't. And in this case, it was imperative that, you know, we did things properly so that we did at least have the opportunity to come here and argue before you guys. At a minimum. Is there any other issue you would like me to address specifically?
That's up to you. You have 2 minutes, 30 minutes.
I just want to double check. In regards to the trajectory rod, it was used to, just as a pen would be used in court or an arm would be used in court, it was just simply to show the direction of how Kevin's testimony changed from the first time he testified to the second time he testified. The statements in regards to Chris Cooney and needing a lawyer contextually obviously only had to do with Chris Cooney. There most certainly was sufficiency of the evidence. Credibility was paramount in this case, and Kevin was impeached, Chris was impeached, Linda's statement was impeached. And at the end of the day, what you had was medical evidence that showed that the bullet was fired at a downward angle from more than 18 to 2 feet away. There was lacking of the flash burn. Therefore, the story that Kevin and Linda told through Chris Cooney couldn't have been possible. And I submit to you that the motion for continuance, Mr. Becker just indicated to you that he's been practicing for 23 years and he's done 100 trials. And with all due respect to Mr. Castillo, I do believe that Ms. Cooney received the assistance of counsel through Mr. Becker. It was their fourth motion to continue. And for a lack of a better term, there's just a point where we have to fish or cut bait, and Judge Gonzalez took in everything into consideration and made the decision that we were proceeding to trial. And I, going back to the 1993 murder, I again just want to submit that the judge limited us very, very much after hours of Petrocelli and hours of things that the state...
Precisely what was told to the jury about that?
About the...
1993 that incident seems too bland a word, but...
That in 1993, Ms. Cooney shot and killed her husband in self-defense, and she was acquitted of it. No other facts were brought in or...
And through whom did that testimony come?
Kevin, Clarita, and Karina.
Okay.
And those were the only... We didn't argue it in opening, nor did we argue it in closing.
And but Kevin disavowed that or not?
He did.
So how did you impeach him?
We asked him if he told Karina that. He said no. So we asked Karina if Kevin, in fact, told her that. And she said yes, which would have been the only way for us to actually bring it in to establish that Karina had that information. Thank you.
Your Honors, and some of those points, what was also came out during the trial as a result of the lower court's ruling was that it was the same gun. And to quote a question that was asked of Kevin Cooney, this is on page 3 of our respondent's brief, the gun you were shot with, that was the same gun that your mom shot your father with, correct? And he replies, yeah. So the jury knew that it was the same gun from the prior shooting. And further, there was a lot more than just what the respondent alludes to that was actually conveyed to the jury. Looking on page 9 of our appellate's brief, just a couple of small quotes for the court's consideration. What was it that he, Kevin, told you about his father? Answer, this is Karina Taylor testifying. He told me I was going to find out eventually and that he would prefer I find out through him. He told me his mother had shot and killed his father when he was very young and that it wasn't self-defense. And then in another section, referring to the stalking, I believe. Did it also play into your mind what happened to you physically on August 2nd? Answer, yes. Question, what did Kevin tell you? Answer, yes. In my opinion, normal people just don't shoot their ex-husband or son. That's on page 9. So what Mr. Becker said is absolutely correct. The bell was absolutely unrung in this case. And although the court may have tried to craft their order by stating that the evidence of the prior shooting was limited to count 4, which I believe was a stalking count, I would submit, and our papers state the same, it is impossible for a jury to compartmentalize these issues. Hearing the whole thing, the complete story, as the state would say, but the key is here, as also mentioned on moving papers, Karina Taylor was previously able to describe the stalking without going into the gun. She described it in her prior grand jury testimony and in her statement to police. She did not previously reference that. It was during the Petrocelli hearing that essentially came out, and I would submit that if you look back at Weber v. State, which says the key is, can the witness accurately describe the crime without referring to the controversy in question? She absolutely could describe referring to the without referring to the controversy in question. What Mr. Becker said is absolutely correct here, and that's that the defense proffered that she carried a concealed weapon. It would have been possible for Ms. Taylor to describe reasonable fear that she had as far as the stalking count without putting this in.
You agree, though, that Weber says we only review determinations of admissibility of evidence and severance in this setting for abuse of discretion, right?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
So we would have to find that Judge Gonzalez abused her discretion.
And I would say she absolutely, abused her discretion, and that's why we brought the motion for severance not once but twice. In terms of some of the other points that were brought up by counsel for the respondent, in terms of the trajectory of the demonstrative exhibit, I would once again go back to the point that this was not something that was admitted during the case in chief or on rebuttal. It was something brought up for the first time. In terms of the motion to continue trial, I'll primarily submit based on the moving papers, but I would note that as a busy firm, we did have multiple trials scheduled during that time frame. We did make every effort to continue it. We asked for a modest continuance, and obviously Mr. Becker's an experienced trial attorney. I've done approximately, well, by now, 12 trials myself, give or take. But we had a cohesive strategy going together in terms of who was going to take out what witnesses. We both knew the case, and due to the court's failure to grant a continuance, Ms. Cooney's defense, she was denied her right to a trial counsel of her choosing. And unless the court has any other questions for me, I will submit.
Okay, thank you, all three counsel, for your excellent arguments today and your briefing. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess.